The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast. This will be episode 10, Fixing Fight Club Naval Warfare in the 21st Century, a continuation of the series within the podcast in which I have tried to lay out a path forward in the 21st century for all facets of the military in the U.S. and by extension, its allies and coalition members to master the tactical, operational, strategic, and grand strategic problem sets and wicked obstacles that are in front of it. So a little bit of housekeeping. I wanted to thank all of my listeners and readers on occasion for getting in touch with me and corresponding and the gentlemanly correspondence. For instance, what I found is after I published my episode where I said we need to kill the Marine Corps, I was expecting an absolute tidal wave of hate. It didn't transpire. And it hurts my heart to even talk about doing that kind of thing because of the august, brave, and incredible history of combat performance of the Marine Corps. But as I mentioned in the episode, it was murdered by General Berger, and it was also murdered by its insistence on completely changing where it is in this world, how it's going to fight in the 21st century, and its absolute absence of forethought in tackling 21st century near peer and peer foes. If you would wish to get in touch with me, then email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You can visit me at my Substack. Both of these addresses just so happen to be in the show notes if you get a chance. Of course, in the show notes, I will show you some of my reference resources for the podcast episode that you're about to listen to. Now, a little bit of personal history. I am formally enlisted in the Navy, and I chose not to get my commission in the Navy to avoid sea duty, but that's another story for another time. I was involved in naval intelligence, and I was exposed, certainly not at the operational and strategic level, but I was exposed to the way the Navy worked in the 1980s when I was in. So with that, we are going to start this episode, which is Naval Warfare in the 21st Century. I just so happen to be recording this podcast as the first podcast during the new administration that has taken office in D.C., and I'm very hopeful that in somehow, some way, folks may find their attention drawing to the things that I've been talking about in this Fixing Fight Club series as maybe either a set of indicators and warnings on what's ahead, and then in a more positive light, how some of these troubles that I forecast with the current course of the DOD, the Pentagon, and the United States Marshall Complex that will encounter, much to their chagrin, the trail of tears that will be the defeats and stalemates in near-peer and peer warfare in the 21st century, for which I think the DOD is uniquely suited not to fight well, not to fight successfully, and to lose much blood and treasure. In 2016, a book was published called The Fleet at Flood Tide, and it was James D. Hornfisher's book. And unfortunately, we have lost him. I consider him contemporaneously as probably one of the best naval historians of our age. He brought a mastery of primary and secondary source documentation and the craft of compelling narrative to his books that made them so great to get into and to eke out a greater understanding of what was going on at this time in this particular snapshot of history during World War II. He talks about the flood tide of the American naval efforts in the Pacific, specifically in this case. He hints at the Atlantic, but for the most part, the lion's share of the book talks about that. And what you discover by listening to him is that somehow, some way, an American Navy that had been bested in December 1941 and continued to be bested through March 1942, and then things turned around with the defeat and annihilation of Kitobutai, which was the Japanese naval aviation leviathan in the four carriers that were lost at the Battle of Midway. What he says, and I'm paraphrasing here, is that somehow the U.S. Navy, along with the Marine Corps and other services, but primarily Nimitz and the U.S. Navy, created a seaborne civilization from the coast of California all the way to Southeast Asia, Japan, Korea, and everything else. Now, the strength of the Navy at the time in May 1945 just so happened to be 6,768 ships on VJ Day later in August. Now, what we discovered today, if we fast forward to 2025 and the state of the United States Navy, we discover that there's 11 aircraft carriers, potentially 12 this year if the Ford can ever get operational. Don't hold your breath. Amphibious ships stands at 31. It should have been 38 according to the forecast 10 years ago. Surface combatants stand at 113. Submarines stand at 67, all nuclear. Combat logistics ships stands at 32. And support ships stand at 32, bringing the total to 287. Those of you old enough to remember the Reagan years will remember the ambition of John Lehman's 600-ship Navy, which wasn't reached in the 1980s, but nonetheless, they attempted to get to that point. What we find today is we find the U.S. surface fleet is simply adrift for so many reasons. Now, again, let's review the strengths here and what we discover, for instance, a total force structure of 347,000 personnel, a reserve force of approximately 100K, a considerable number of fixed-wing aircraft and rotary-wing aircraft, and an entire fleet and being that I didn't take the time to enumerate, considering the merchant marine forces that would be supporting the U.S. Navy in wartime, the ships that the Army actually owns but would come under the Navy umbrella in the event of wartime and such. But I thought that it wasn't too relevant to this present discussion. Now, mind you, those who have listened to or read my podcasts in the past, even on Chasing Ghosts, you will note that I am a carrier skeptic. I think that the carrier is the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century for a variety of reasons, but I'm not going to waste too much of the time in this podcast to go over what I've already talked about in Chasing Ghosts, episode 34 in Dispatch number 6, in which I provided a written essay that really footnoted and brought the hand receipts for why so many things are awry with the dependence on the carrier and the carrier armada as the primary means by which the United States Navy and its Blue Water Surface Force projects power. I had mentioned earlier about the 12 carriers instead of 11 carriers. That 12th carrier for 2025 is the USS Ford, which has been an unparalleled disaster in carrier construction. The first of its class, using what's called in the contemporary defense industry, Argo, concurrent technology, which means that at the time of building, when the plans were laid, when the money was found, some of the technology was at a level of immaturity that didn't assure that we had all the answers scribbled out, in that it had suffered through operational test and came out with a green light. That is certainly not the case. It cannot reliably launch and retrieve aircraft. It has 11 weapons elevators with this electromagnetic system instead of a steam catapult, which has been the motivational engine system for launching and retrieving aircraft and working weapons elevators and such on a carrier since, well, before World War II, actually. And I'm going to suspend my disbelief. I'm going to tell you that if the USS Ford, which is supposed to succeed the Nimitz class as the next supercarrier generation, let's suppose that it worked flawlessly. Nonetheless, it is still a non-starter in 21st century warfare, because not only are we in the middle of a revolution in military affairs when it comes to robotics, autonomous targeting, and hypervelocity weapon systems, but when it comes to integrated air and missile defense, the Aegis system and the spy radar and the other organizational technology that makes the Burke class, launched in 1991, one can say arguably the last successful hull launched by the U.S. Navy, is part of the carrier armada to provide a web of surveillance, to provide this ongoing blue water or littoral water, depending on the proximity to land, IAMD, that integrated air and missile defense, that area denial exercise to ensure that in a war of leakers, when missiles are aloft, they've reached apogee, or they're wavetopping, and they're on their way to intercept the carrier or any of her escorts, that all of them will be smacked down and shot down. Of course, that's an impossible feat in the missile age, and we'll explain that later. So not only do I think the U.S. Navy as a blue water surface force is too little, too late, and incredibly incompetent for a variety of reasons, but a complete reimagination and rethinking of naval warfare in the 21st century must prevail. Somebody has to do the heavy intellectual lifting and red teaming and contrarian discussions to figure out, much as the Japanese did before December 7th, 1941, in their tactical decision games and their war games, in which they would have members of the Japanese Imperial Staff acting as members of the U.S. Naval Staff, so that they could war game all the worst case, best case, and easiest case scenarios in the fight ahead. They would do that, and certain officers would suffer the slings and arrows as they beat the starch out of a plan and said, these are the following things operationally that are out of order, these are the following things in employment that aren't going to work, and these are the following recommendations that we have when it comes to addressing this and fixing our tactics, techniques, and procedures for the wars ahead. The Navy, the U.S. Navy, is so bad at so many things, but I'm going to confine myself to a short list. Since 1991, as I mentioned, with the commissioning of the whole of the Arleigh Burke and all the Arleigh Burkes that have succeeded since that time and being constructed, as a destroyer, it is a redoubtable and remarkable ship, and I have nothing but praise for it, even though it is aging badly for what 21st century naval warfare is going to involve. Now, I cannot say the same of her successors. Her successors would be the littoral combat ship, what's referred to as the little crappy ship. This is a ship that for almost 20 years since it was first commissioned, it was imagined in the 1990s, and then it realized contractual obligations that were let for it to be built starting in, I think, 2001, 2003. These ships are so bad, they were built on a modular basis where, oh, we need an anti-submarine warfare module, we need an anti-air module, we need a minesweeping module. Well, all we'll do is several things. Number one, we'll make them all modular, we'll plug these modules in. None of the modules have succeeded. Not only that, they have trouble with their storm ratings and operational test. They did an experiment with the crew where you would have blue and gold crews that were very minimal, and they've suffered enormous engineering casualties on a persistent basis, much like the engineering casualties that have kept the Queen Elizabeth and her consort, the two British conventionally powered carriers, not wanting to go very far from the coast of England because they break down so consistently. The little crappy ship is followed by the Zumwalt, the DDG-1000, DD in this case being a destroyer, a very hideous-looking tumblehome design, and take a look at pictures if you get a chance, of a ship that was supposed to be all about the stealth. This stealth fixation, which I have faced down technically and rhetorically in a previous episode, you can find that at Chasing Ghosts. It is such a lark. It is such an expensive chasing down, well, chasing down ghosts, isn't it? It is such an expensive pursuit of a technology that, at the margins, gives a force and near-peer and peer competitions no value whatsoever, because all radar cross-sections, no matter how reduced, under a stealth profile, are detectable by long-wave radar, for which most near-peer and peer nations possess already. Not only is the ship aesthetically hideous, not only is its naval architecture suspect, because it too had operational test questions when it came to sea state 3-5, but also it had a gun that was mounted on it initially, and the Navy has severe problems when it comes to gunnery as we speak. But in this case, it was going to have something called a lurlap. And in that lurlap, it turned out that those rounds would be $1 million a piece. And the Navy says, after building this, well, maybe we're not going to put that gun on there because the rounds are too expensive. So they put vertical launch systems in it so that it could launch conventional SM munitions. That would be standard missile munitions and other variants that are out there that the Navy uses as their primary missiles for warfare. Even that is bad, really bad. The beatdown goes on because what we discovered is that the U.S. Navy's surface fleet has fired nearly 400 individual munitions while battling Iran-backed Houthi rebels in the Red Sea over the past 15 months. That includes the firing of 120 SM-2 missiles, 80 SM-6 missiles, 160 rounds from destroyers and cruisers, 5-inch main guns, as well as a combined 20 ESSM, those are Evolved Sea Sparrow missiles, and SM-3 missiles. All told, Navy ships, aircraft, and submarines have engaged more than 400 Houthi aerial drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles, mind you, Yemen, Houthi, ballistic missiles, since October 2023, when the Yemen-based group began attacking vessels transiting the Red Sea in solidarity with the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Now, I will put the where that quote is from Jeff Zielewitz, and I'll put that in the show notes so that you can dig around and see what you can find from a technical standpoint. Those SM-6 missiles, by the way, let's see, they fired 80 of them. Those are a cool $4 million a pop, which means that's a rather chilly one-third of $1 billion in SM-6 expenditures alone from the U.S. Navy to fight a foe that doesn't have any Navy to speak of apart from 1975 and older vintage Soviet patrol boats in their Navy as we speak. Now, mind you, that DDG-1000, the Zumwalt, what that was designed to do was to fire something called the 155mm advanced gun system, but that weapon was uniquely designed for much longer ranges and thus far too specialized for general shipboard installation, especially at $1 million a round. Did I mention those Mark 41 launch systems that you will find on practically every ship in the U.S. surface Navy? Those Mark 41 vertical launching systems, and you've probably seen the photos or footage of these missiles on a plume of fire and smoke launching from U.S. Navy surface ships and going aloft, they cannot be replenished or reconstituted at sea. They must go back to port in order to replenish this. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later on and why that's such a huge impact in the war of leakers that is going to be 21st century naval warfare. So I've talked about the numbers. I've talked about the ships. I've talked about the inadequacy of building ships that are worth their salt. The USN, it is basically a 20th century force with 21st century ornamentation, But no ornamentation that will prevent these ships from becoming future fish apartments, which is my opinion of the carrier forces and their attendant vessels that protect those large ships. Then we have the F-35, which has taken the place of the redoubtable F-18s, which are slowly being taken out of the fleet as the primary naval aviation strike aircraft. This would be the F-35 Bravo and Charlie, which are the short takeoff and landing and carrier variants of the F-35 Alpha, which the Air Force is employing. Again, fifth generation stealth aircraft. It's just, I get why the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon would be so enamored with the concepts and the technology, but stealth is not worth the cost as far as what it does for combat effectiveness. In recent testimony before the House, it was revealed that the F-35 Bravos and Charlies are rife with problems, among which is, on occasion, they rust at sea. They have a very difficult time keeping them in a readiness level above 30%, which means that for every aircraft that is viable and able to fly, two of the aircraft are just not ready. They are in no condition to be used in combatant operations. Now, mind you, remember what this means for those who are my perennial listeners. We talked about the rule of threes, which means that if I have 100,000 troops, I can send a third of them into combat. A third of them are going to be in reconstitution and training and such. And then the other third are going to be doing administrative activities, school activities, things that take them out of the running. For instance, when you look at the 82nd Airborne Division, yes, it has three brigades of airborne troops, but only one of those brigades, a brigade minus, mind you, is on the QRF, the Quick Reaction Force standby, to be able to go, quote, anywhere in the world in 24 hours, end of quote. And there are a number of other things that are existentially preventing the U.S. Navy from doing its primary task of blue water combat projection with its surface and subsurface fleet and its associated aviation assets. For instance, one can look at the USS Bonham Richard, a ship in the Gator Navy, the Marine Corps Navy, the Navy that is afloat to provide the means by which one can project amphibious power in littoral regions. That fire, a catastrophic fire that occurred on July 12, 2020, this billion-dollar ship burned for 5 days and severely damaged the ship. And then what happens? They find, and this has been just a crucible and cavalcade of calamities for the U.S. Navy, where they tried to pin this on an E-1, E-2 seaman in the Navy on starting this entire fire. They discovered, for instance, that ex post facto, it was not his fault, and it was not for the salacious reasons that they made it out to be. For instance, what I found very eerie about it is that on one of the battleships, this was after World War II, there was a 16-inch gun turret that went up, and they blamed it on some kind of homosexual liaison and food fight between members of the gun crew, but it turns out that that wasn't the case. So in this case, they chase their tails and they go after this. And that's not the worst of it. The worst of it, of course, is lives lost, the ship lost, $1 billion in ship, by the way, up in flames, quite literally. But responding to it, there weren't adults, apparently, in uniform, who could respond in a timely fashion. Firefighting was substandard, and preparations for fighting fires on board the ship itself were really substandard. And you've got to remember this when it comes to modern navies since the turn of the 20th century. When it comes to firefighting and damage control, and this is what cost the Japanese to a certain extent because they didn't have the maturation of tactics, techniques, and procedures and technologies that the U.S. Navy employed during World War II to actually save its ships. For instance, in a U.S. Navy carrier during World War II, it was standing operating procedure that once you had taken all the fuel lines, employed those fuel lines for fueling aircraft, boats, whatever the case may be, all of those fuel lines were bled out so that they wouldn't be clear and present dangers for fire. This was part of their preventative damage control techniques that they employed. None of these seemed to be deployed in 2020 when it came to this Bonham Richard fire. Then we have the twin collisions of ships and the injury and deaths of sailors in 2017 as a result of a lack of training, a lack of watchfulness, and simply, and apparently this is in the surface warfare community, and I'm coming to you not as a SWO, which is a surface warfare officer, but members of that community who happen to be friends and acquaintances that I've discussed some of this with, they simply don't have an environment in which the teaching and training would have led to anything but what happened on those two ships in 2017. And as with so many accidents at sea, or in this case, industrial accidents, which is actually what this was, thank the gods this wasn't in wartime, you discover that the training had been insufficient. The watchfulness of the bridge crew was absolutely and alarmingly, it was substandard by any standard whatsoever in any Navy, whether third world, developing world, or first world. Just awful. And I will put in the show notes an examination of what happened during those collisions. I will also tell you that the senior leadership, the flag officers, the admirals, for instance, Admiral Gilday, who will go down as one of the worst chiefs of naval operations in the history of that august body, that if you are an officer, and there's other ones, of course, who we need not name right now, who is absolutely obsessed with IED, which some people call DEI, but I like to be more accurate in the cadence, or political correctness, or bothering one's sailors and Marines with training that has no relevance whatsoever to warfighting. Gilday is just as bad as that U.S. Coast Guard commandant who was just fired for concentrating so much on IED and political correctness to the detriment of real combat training. Let's get to some real nuts and bolts here about the readiness of this force. The Arleigh Burke is the primary destroyer. There's a cruiser class called Ticonderoga that has had its own difficulties and misfires. This was acquired between 1983 and 1994, and now the Navy has a DDG-X program, which it's going to use to replace these Ticonderoga-class ships. Now, the latest data I have is that the U.S. Navy has partially reversed course on its controversial plans to decommission the last of its Ticonderoga-class cruisers by 2027. Most of these ships tend to have a 30 to 35-year shelf life. Unless you're a little crappy ship, then you can find yourself retired by the half bushel 5 years into a 30-year shelf life. Now, the new decision regarding the Ticonderogas is part of an ambitious Navy-wide strategy that includes a call to substantially increase the readiness of warships and other key assets within the next 3 years. Again, this is a lot of bloviating and not much delivery on what their ambition is. Because they're also saying that 12 of the oldest Arleigh Burke-class destroyers will see their service lives extended. The Navy announced the life extension plans for the USS Gettysburg, the USS Chosen, and the USS Cape St. George. Stay tuned, because there are still, I think it's six of them that are slated for decommissioning in the next 2 years. We'll see what happens. Now, let us briefly, before we talk about some of the solutions to the problems that I've talked about, let's talk about aircraft. So when it comes to fixed-wing aircraft, currently, FA-18s, there's 420 in service. There's currently 30 F-35 Charlies in service. E-2 Hawkeyes, which are for AEW, there's 83 of those in service, and they're probably ordering more of those. As a matter of fact, when it comes to the Lightning, I read the number as 30, and there's 204 on order. Remember, when it comes to the F-35 Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie, the Bravo and Charlie being carrier-capable aircraft are sort of arcane and esoteric in the taxonomy of the F-35 series. because there is an ambition to build 2,000 of these, but that includes the Alpha, which is the Air Force variant, which isn't as heavy and a little more flexible as a result of not having the reinforced fuselage and all the necessary accoutrement to land on a carrier aircraft and to launch at a rather rapid acceleration. So I'm not going to articulate all the numbers for the electronic warfare maritime patrol aircraft like the P-3 and the P-8 and the transport aircraft that come off of both land bases and are carrier compatible. But those numbers are approximately, and remember, we're talking fixed wing here only, approximately 400 aircraft. And then for their rotary wing aircraft, they have 26 CH-53s. Those are the Super Stallions. They have 454 SH-60 Seahawks, which is the naval variant of the UH-60 Blackhawk, and I think 27 Ospreys. Remember, this is apart from the Navy Department's Marine Corps. These are Navy assigned, not Marine Corps flagged Ospreys, numbering 27. You would never find me getting near an Osprey except to look at it on the ground, because I would not want to get in one because they are so bloody dangerous. Now, you will notice an absence here. That absence would be a seaplane. Now, why in the 21st century would one need a seaplane? You will note that in episode 7, where I posited that we need to kill the Marine Corps, that one of the reasons their stand-in-force notions on the second and third island chains of putting Marines out there to man missile batteries that would take on Chinese or Chinese-affiliated assets, that if somebody stubbed their toe or lost an arm or was severely injured in any fashion whatsoever, whether, by the way, this is in peacetime or wartime, we have no modality apart from helicopters to go in and get them in a rapid fashion. Now, those of you who are aware of it, helicopters don't have long legs. There are PAVE variants, and you'll see the refueling tube that's forward of these, where, yes, they can refuel from, let's say, a C-130 in the Pacific, especially when it comes to the first 10 days of wartime with China. Most of these will be lost, and operational readiness rates will go through the floor, and they will have a severe incapacity to use a rotary wing aircraft, especially if the rotary wing aircraft happens to have to come off of a ship that'll be within missile range of the Chinese. How does one do this without seaplanes? Now, I'm not saying that the seaplanes themselves wouldn't be missile sponges, but absent seaplanes, and of course, if you look at the glorious history of the PBY and Allied seaplanes, and even Japanese seaplanes, by the way, during World War II, magnificent aircraft that had thousands of miles of range available to them and very reliable, very sturdy. We have nothing like that in the inventory. But we do happen to have an ally who has built probably what is the most significant and reliable seaplane, which is called, I think it's the US-1 that the Japanese produce. Imagine if we went through the American acquisition process, it would take a quarter century to come up with a very mediocre object at the end that would be posing as a seaplane. In this case, one of our allies has one ready to purchase, ready to use. Don't hold your breath. So you see that I am in a mood here where I think that the U.S. Navy is, and I repeat, a 20th century naval surface combat modality fighting in a 21st century near-peer and peer conflict it doesn't understand. I want to cover two things very quickly that I haven't assessed before I rather hubristically offer my recommendations for short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term fixes, in this case, fixing Fight Club, in this case, fixing the U.S. Navy, for winning either a stalemate and not being defeated in a 21st century battle with near-peer and peer competitors. In Episode 5, Fixing Fight Club, 21st Century Nuclear Renaissance, yeah, I'm going to use the John Cleese pronunciation because I really like it. I talked about the nuclear triad, and I talked about the necessity of making a complete reappraisal and reassessment of how that is conducted, and to get rid of the air wings and to get rid of the fixed silo missiles, in this case the Minuteman III, which by ambition is supposed to be succeeded by the Sentinel, but we all know how that acquisition program is going to go down. I talked about nuclear submarines. I talked about subsurface ballistic missile submarines and SSBNs, and the fact that SSGNs are some of those two guided missile submarines and such, and our SSNs, our fast attack submarines and such. No one has a nuclear navy that rivals that of the United States, despite the fact that there are only 67 in total in service. Mind you, rule of threes, as we just discussed, so you can do the math, but you can also do the math on this. For instance, we recently had a SSN dockside for service for a little over 7 years. There are four shipyards in the United States. There's Norfolk, there's Puget Sound, there's Pearl Harbor, and there's Portsmouth. Four. Two of those can build nuclear vessels. All 67 of these submarines that I talked about are nuclear vessels. As a matter of fact, I think we just celebrated the 80th anniversary of the USS Nautilus taking its first around-the-world tour as a successful Rickover-inspired nuclear submarine that would lay the groundwork for giving us this incredible capability that no one but the Russians can come close to. Not only am I a tremendous fan of nuclear submarines and the submariners that I have met who were always a cut above, but I always thought that with the little crappy ship, the littoral combat ship, what really failed in that entire program was, of course, naval imagination, martial imagination, because what we should have finally done, and we have no diesel-electric submarines or diesel submarines of any type in service currently commissioned in the U.S. Navy, we should have gone to the Germans with their Type 214 diesel-electric submarine and bought a bushel of these and inaugurated, initiated, and did all the sufficient training and everything that comes with a new ship in the naval force to be the littoral combat ship. Now, one thing that's interesting about diesel-electric submarines is not only has the technology really moved into the 21st century in a vigorous fashion. As a matter of fact, it was a Chinese diesel-electric submarine that came to the surface amid some carrier armadas during an exercise in the Pacific years ago because they're so bloody quiet. As a matter of fact, they happen to be, in some respects, quieter than a nuclear submarine because despite the dampening and the technology that goes into making nuclear submarines black holes in the oceans, and mind you, a lot of them achieve that kind of technological supremacy. In this case, with a diesel electric and a trained crew for a small period of time of 24 to 48 hours, it is quieter when it comes to detection than a nuclear submarine. So the case that I'm making here is that we need diesel-electric submarines to serve the littoral combat ship ambitions of the little crappy ship that failed in such a spectacular fashion. Solutions. So you've heard me belly aching during this podcast episode about everything that is wrong with the Navy, and this was by no means a comprehensive and exhaustive list. I am certain there are people who are presently serving or may have gotten out recently who can fill my Zodiac to the gunnels with all kinds of reasons that I did not elucidate or illustrate about why the Navy is in such a bad way. So I feel it is a partial obligation on my part that I didn't have to achieve with my episode on getting rid of the Marine Corps, because we need to get rid of the Marine Corps, and that was my solution. In this case, I have a list that elucidates the short-term, intermediate, and long-term possible solutions to fix what ails the United States Navy. Now, in the short term, I think that there's going to be a combination here. In 1949, there was something called the Revolt of the Admirals, and it was a policy and funding dispute within the U.S. government during the Cold War, in this case 1949, involving a number of retired and active duty U.S. Navy admirals. This was partly driven by inter-service rivalry. Remember, it is this time 47, 48, and 49 where the Army Air Force becomes the U.S. Air Force, and the Navy sought to carve out a role for itself in strategic bombing, which the Air Force saw as one of its primary roles. Now, the cancellation of the aircraft carrier USS United States and accusations of impropriety by several admirals in regard to the purchase of the Convair B-36 Peacemaker bomber led to an investigation by the House, and that was chaired by, yes, Carl Vinson, who is the namesake for the Nimitz supercarrier, which is superseded now by the Ford not-so-supercarrier. And what you discovered is that, at last, these admirals grabbed a pair in this dispute, and they said, these are the war-making assets and skills that we have, and this is why we're going to stand toe-to-toe with the Air Force and carve out our own piece of the action when it comes to strategy. I wish there had been a revolt of the admirals when it came to this entire IED, DEI, politically correct fiasco that has consumed so much blood and treasure and so drained the combat efficacy of all the forces to include the U.S. Navy. There were four-star admirals in World War II overseeing a Navy, as I elucidated earlier, that was far greater than the size and span of the Navy that we have today, and that Navy just so happened to be involved in very severe combat operations on a global basis for almost 5 years. Right now, there's about 270 admirals. Those are flag officers of every stripe from 07 to 010, leading to a four-star admiral, of which there are 10 instead of the four that we had during World War II, and 32 vice admirals today. Streamline them. Get rid of them. Spike them. We don't need this many flag officers in the U.S. Navy. I say the same thing about the Army. I said the same thing about the Corps. And I will say the same thing about the Air Force in the next episode. There are too many flag officers, and there are very rarely any of them of merit in a combat theater. Now, the second thing I wanted to offer is the Rickover effect. If it wasn't for Admiral Hyman Rickover, very eccentric, extraordinarily brilliant, and the father of the U.S. nuclear Navy, primarily the submarine Navy, this Navy today does not tolerate the kind of eccentricity and the kind of rebelliousness that was of the nature of Admiral Rickover. Brilliant in so many respects, he would have never made it past probably captain, which would be 06 in the U.S. Navy today, if he made it that far, because the U.S. Navy today lacks martial imagination entirely, is very cookie cutter, is very conventional. And keep this in mind when it comes to promotions to flag rank. What this means is that at the 26 to 28 year mark, when one is probably eligible for a flag promotion, from 06, in this case, captain in the U.S. Navy, it would be a bird colonel in the Army or the Air Force or the Marines, you have to have done three things very well. You must be a political and bureaucratic knife fighter of the highest order. Number two, you must be able to wear political masks on what it is that you think everyone in your chain of command above you need you to do in order to achieve the rank of a flag officer. And last but not least, you need to have a perfect fitness record, a perfect performance record, which means that you will be risk averse. You will pursue positions that won't put you in the hazard, and you will not be by nature a warrior. You will be somebody who is a bureaucratic knife fighter. That's how you get stars in the U.S. Armed Forces. So, off of that soapbox, we need to reduce the number of flag officers and completely revamp and reconstitute the fashion in which we find them, promote them, and put them in a combat capacity. We need to bring back Bofors and Ehrliching gunnery and picket ships into the U.S. Navy, because this is the missile age. This is the leaker age. This is the age of integrated air and missile defense. And it means that whoever has the most superior missile defense, and by the way, quantity has a quality all its own, they will be the ones who prevail in this fight. What is one of the totems that we employ at Chasing Ghosts when it comes to a tagline for what we've talked about now for going over 2 years? It's this: wars are won by the least incompetent. We don't have these smaller caliber rapid-fire weapons like the Bofors and the Ehrlichs, the 37 millimeters and such that were used, for instance, in the picket ships off of the coast of Okinawa, Japan, in 1945 during that invasion in which U.S. naval forces suffered some of their most egregious losses as a result of kamikaze aircraft that eerily emulate the behavior of terminally maneuvering large UAV classes today. Remember, these are short-term solutions, and these Ehrlichs and Bofors anti-aircraft weaponry are readily available on the European market, where we can go there, buy them at a bazaar, train up on them, and put them on our fleet. Okay, now I'm going to say something heretical. Well, I've been saying heretical things this entire podcast series, but in this case, manned aviation, like carriers and manned tanks, is the carrier and crossbow of the 21st century. It is time for unmanned combat aircraft to take the lead. And it is time for the Navy, for instance, to invest in what it takes to make that happen. Let me give you a dirty little secret when it comes to carrier aircraft and what it means to put a strike package together and deliver it beyond the defensive and protected envelope of a carrier armada itself. It is this: remember the rule of thirds. Remember that carrier air wings number less than 80 aircraft now, and that doesn't mean that they're all strike aircraft like FA-18s or F-35s. Remember that F-35 Bravo Charlie has a combat radius of approximately 750 nautical miles. And also remember that the U.S. Navy recently came out and they said that we can't afford to put our carriers within 1,000 nautical miles of the Chinese coast or those island chains because of the possibility of DF-21s, DF-25s, or any variant of their anti-ship missiles landing in the lap of the carrier admirals who are manning those ships off the coast of China. So if I want to sortie a strike package, and that strike package, especially when I'm talking about a near-peer opponent like the Chinese, I have to have seed aircraft, suppression of enemy air defense, so that I can blow through a corridor of their integrated air and missile defense in order for the strike aircraft carrying their smart bombs or not so smart bombs into the Chinese targeting area where they're going to lob their ordnance. When those aircraft leave the CAP, the carrier, the combat air patrol, which is protecting the carrier, or the BCAP, the barrier combat air patrol, which is the combat manned combat aircraft air patrol that is circling above the entire armada protecting the fleet, you are looking at a strike package of 10 or less aircraft. How many of them will come back in a near or peer fight, in this case a peer fight, with the Chinese? My guess is not very many. Now, put yourself in this scenario and imagine. So you put all this money into the aircraft carrier. You have 5,000 minus folks on the carrier alone. You have thousands in the various ships, to include the submarines, that are protecting said carrier. And in the end, your strike package is less than 10 aircraft. How does any of this calculation make sense? Hence, my call for unmanned aircraft. Now, I am not a fan of keeping the Ford. I am not a fan of keeping the Nimitz. I am not a fan of keeping any carriers. I don't know what the cadence of retirement's going to be. In my case, I would recommend one a year until we've gotten rid of these future fish apartments. But nonetheless, let's suspend your disbelief and you say, nope, what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep all the carriers. But Bill, I'm going to adopt your plan and we're going to have unmanned aircraft leaving those carrier decks. I imagine that those unmanned aircraft, depending on what range they would need, would they be stealth, would they be non-stealth? As you know from earlier discussions I've had, I think that stealth is so 20th century when it comes to its fighting efficacy. But in this case, if you want stealth unmanned aircraft, I'll give that to you. I am here to tell you that if you looked at the concept of operations and the concept of employment for said unmanned combat aircraft, you could probably send two, three, four, five times as many, some smart guy will do the math out there, as you can of F-18s or F-35s. And possibly, just possibly, somebody else has to do the math on this, you can do it from a range that takes your carrier out of the loop, out of the effective range of those DF anti-ship Chinese missiles. We'll move on. Please, Navy's operational test and evaluation force and everything that that comes with. These are the folks who do the concepts of operations, the concepts of employment, the functional descriptions, the testing and evaluation and shock testing, and show that all of these modalities of war are good to go in peer conflict. Because it seems like the little crappy ship, the Zumwalt, the Ford, the F-35 Bravo Charlie, and a host of other problematic, exquisite platforms and weapon systems are not up to snuff. Who's responsible for that? Why don't they have an organization in the U.S. Navy that does a by God sober test of all of this, and if it comes out in a way that either embarrasses them or has shortcomings that are significant to success in combat, then make it known, make it so, and fix it. Moving on, again, these are short-term recommendations that I have. We need to prioritize the Aegis Homeland Defense Systems. Either you have them on the destroyers or the land-borne Aegis systems with their spy radars. These happen to be very sophisticated IAMD modalities. And as I have stressed early on in this Fighting Fix Club series, America needs to reassess, reconstitute, take a knee, and take a determination that the defense of the homeland itself is more important than any combat projection can ever be. So in this case, why not take the Aegis cruisers and not send them boring holes in the ocean, planet-wide, wearing themselves out, coming back rust-laden, but have them cruise the littoral or not-so-littoral shores of the West Coast and the East Coast to provide a picket force against incoming ICBMs, IRBMs, or FOBs, fractional orbital bombardment systems, which are glide path munitions that will be hypervelocity and they will land in your lap. We don't have the means, as I discussed in my episode concerning the nuclear renaissance, to service these targets that are inbound. Once that object reaches apogee, tips, and all of those MIRVs or single munitions start their hypervelocity parabola into the United States homeland, we can use these ships, at least in one fashion or another, to bolster that IAMD that is presently non-existent. And I have bad news for all my former Marines or members of the Gator Navy. The Gator Navy is the amphibious Navy. The amphibious Navy is the Navy that supports, shall I say, contested beach access, which, by the way, as I explained in the Marine Corps episode number 7, that America has not reached a contested beach since 1950. We do not have the maritime connectors. We don't have the helicopters that are invulnerable to missiles and small arms and SAFADs. We don't have the capability to project from these ships offshore onto a contested beach. So why do we have this Gator Navy? I'm not saying one would retire these ships necessarily. Could they be pre-positioning ships for a Marine amphibious force if we keep the Marines that is there waiting to do NEOs, which are non-combatant evacuation operations, supporting embassy sieges, or whatever the case may be? We could do that. But by the way, when it comes to Marine Expeditionary Forces, there's been a vacancy in that capability for the last 5 years. As a matter of fact, the last time this happened in Africa, the Marines didn't step in the breach. SOCOM had to step in the breach out of Europe. Mind you, this list is a work in progress. Here's my intermediate list. Phase out the carriers. Phased out manned fixed-wing aircraft. We need unmanned long loiter UAVs assigned to the Navy. We need unmanned combat vehicles assigned to the Navy. We need unmanned surface vehicles. We need unmanned subsurface vehicles. As I mentioned earlier, when it comes to combat search and rescue and intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, I'll bet one can find a seaplane, the Japanese have it available for you to purchase if you wish, that would fill some of those niches readily. Retire the littoral combat ships, the little crappy ships, and please, again, this is an intermediate goal on the list, let's consider and do a very thorough study of the effectiveness and employment of diesel-electric submarines, for which we could probably buy at $500 million a pop, maybe 8 for every nuclear submarine. I am open to my audience to correct me on those numbers. Currently, it costs $500 million for a German diesel-electric submarine. And easily to replace our nuclear submarines, remember, we only have 2 nuclear-capable shipyards, it would cost us probably in the billions to do so. So there would be a cost advantage in the numbers that one could field of these diesel-electric submarines. We need to expand shipbuilding. As I mentioned, we have 4 major shipyards, of which 2 are nuclear-capable. Do we need to expand to Croatia? Do we need to go to South Korea? Do we need to go to Japan to get holes laid and find a way? Once we find a ship worth building, because the Ford ain't it, the LCS ain't it, and the DDG 1000 Zumwalt ain't it, and I'm here to tell you, the DDG-X and the FFG Frigate-X, those 2 programs that are in the offing right now, they're running into severe acquisition problems. Of course. And a possible use for that Gator Navy is to fill the gap for blue water anchorages for logistics supply that would be necessary out of the missile range of the Chinese DFs or whatever force we find ourselves arrayed against in the 21st century. So for long term, what do we need to do? For the long term, and this is very long term, I think that naval surface combatants, due to the fact that this is the missile age and will only increase as far as a missile and FPV and UAS age, that surface combat forces are probably going to be less viable than they ever were in the history of naval warfare, which means that the balance of submarines versus surface vessels may need to tilt in favor of submarine forces. Additionally, there needs to be a complete overhaul of the JSIDs, of the Defense Acquisition System. I often joke with friends and colleagues that in the 1960s, the Soviet Union saw the writing on the wall and saw that their sclerotic and arthritic Sovietized central planning mechanisms for acquiring weapons of war was substandard. And how would they defeat the U.S. capitalist empire when it came to building things that were both efficient and effective? Well, it turns out that the DoD adopted a Sovietized acquisition system, and that's what we have today. There needs to be a Manhattan Project in this, and there needs to be some kind of reclamation of what worked in the past in a renaissance of what will work in the future that doesn't work with the present acquisition system in the DoD. I mentioned submarine forces having to take the preponderance of numbers over surface forces, and I'm certain that this will cause a lot of chattering and fainting couches to be manned by the usual suspects. But nonetheless, these considerations need to be taken more seriously. And in addition to the SSN, this fast attack submarine, in addition to the SSG and the guided missile submarine, in addition to the SSBN, the ballistic missile submarine, we need to adopt something called the SSDN, which is the drone swarm submarine that would have thousands, tens of thousands, depending on where the technology's at the time, once these can be fielded. That would be a fourth class of submarine that will be very useful in the coming revolutions in military affairs that are going to blacken the skies as we proceed forward in this century. And then lastly, non-kinetic interception. This would be lasers and microwaves and such. I think we're at the precipice. I don't think that we're at a place where one can say that these can be effectively fielded anytime soon due to physics problems, acquisition problems, energy problems on the ships, of course, and things like that. As a matter of fact, my friend and colleague, Doug Nussbaum, out at the Naval Postgraduate School, is fond of saying that Clancy said that tactics are for amateurs and that logistics is for professionals, but energy is for war winners. Thanks, Doug. I know I paraphrased you, but I hope I got it right, but I wanted to give you credit for that, of course. So with that, I know that I've breathily and ambitiously posited some things that most likely go against the grain of the way the U.S. Navy characterizes itself and thinks about what future conflict is going to look like. So with that, I thank you for listening. I look forward to your comments, recommendations for future podcast episodes and such. My next podcast episode, I'm hoping will kind of bookend my Fixing Fight Club series I'm doing, where I talk about the U.S. Air Force and what it needs to do to unscrew itself for 21st century near-peer and peer warfare. If you wish to get in touch with me, please visit my Substack or email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. So with that, I thank you again for your solicitude and listenership. This is Bill out.